This is The After Party, live with Kim McAllister. Pick a couch, grab a drink, and settle into the conversation.
Good afternoon. It is The After Party live following the Mark Thompson Show. Mark will be live tomorrow again. And I do want to mention one thing he forgot to say is that tomorrow, right out of the gate on the Mark Thompson Show, please watch and listen, because the one of the candidates for mayor of San Francisco will be on the show, and that's Mark Farrell. So again, that's right at the top of the Mark Thompson Show. It's going to be really good, followed by David K. Johnston. Jefferson Graham will be on the show as well. Again, that's the Mark Thompson Show, and that's tomorrow at 11 a.m. So, okay, but let's after party it up. Why don't we? Please click the like button. I appreciate that. And working really hard to get to 2,000 subscribers. So if you could click the subscribe button, I would appreciate that as well. Thank you for being here. I appreciate it. Let's talk about some things going on in San Francisco. And as if it's not already complicated enough to park in the city, now they're going to crack down on parking even more. That's what we have to look forward to. Have you ever walked out to your car in San Francisco and there's a big parking ticket on your windshield? And we're not talking, you know, maybe in a city like Petaluma where I live, it'd be $40, $50, maybe $60. San Francisco, we're talking $100, $119. I mean, this is not a little parking ticket, right? And sometimes it's hard to find a place to park. So this is what's happening in San Francisco, this crackdown on parking enforcement. Now, they're pretty good at getting their money. You know, if you're over time in San Francisco, if your meter has run out, they're pretty good at coming along and finding you. But this is under the guise of traffic-related injuries and fatalities being more common. And so a crackdown on drivers parking illegally, they say, is one way to make the city's streets safer. Is it? Because the cars aren't moving. So is that the way? Or is it you just want more money? Because I don't know. The San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency director, his name is Jeffrey Tumlin, he's announcing this plan this week of increasing the number of citations that officers start to issue this month. So it's a week-long surge of intensive enforcement in different supervisor districts to enforce safety-oriented rules. Mm-hmm. That is an effort to increase safety on streets and sidewalks for drivers and pedestrians. So they're going to look for cars parked on the sidewalk or cars parked in a bike lane, crosswalks, touching a crosswalk a little bit, daylit zones, that's cars parked too close to crosswalks, I guess, to enforce the laws that are already existing. The quote is, parking and obstructing sidewalks has never been legal. We've listened to residents and city government's concerns about this issue. As long as you're parked legally, there's nothing to worry about. But not parked legally, they're going to come find you. Just a little note there, it's coming. Also wanted to, speaking of parking, talk a little bit about this story, which is, I guess there's a scam for people that use Fast Track, which is pretty much, I want to say, all of us. So if you use Bay Area bridges, you pretty much have to have Fast Track, right? They're very few and far between, and there's none on the Golden Gate Bridge. People working in toll booths actually collecting tolls anymore. For now, it's you have a little machine, you drive through the booth, you hear a little beep, beep, and they've just sucked some money out of your account. And when your account gets too low, it's replenished. This is the full Fast Track thing. And now it's not only for bridges, which is where it started in the Bay Area, but also for some of these lanes, these carpool lanes, or not necessarily carpool lanes, but what is it? Peak efficiency hour lanes, where you can pay to use the HOV lane. Right? And so then it's Fast Track as well. They suck money out of your account that way too. There is a scam targeting Bay Area drivers related to Fast Track. Here's the tolls on the Golden Gate Bridge. Here's what happens. So this out of SF Gate, they say some people that use Fast Track receive text messages notifying them of fast track fees with a link. And that link leads to a fraudulent website. Don't be fooled, my friends. If you receive such a text, please do not click on the link. This according to the transit agency here in the Bay Area. They say FastTrack does not request payment by text with a link to a website. That's never how they do it. The Metropolitan Transportation Commission runs the FastTrack system. They say similar scams were reported in February and in March, and it's pretty much the same scam. It's coming in a couple different waves. But now the scammers are broadening things up and reaching wider. So it's now being reported in other cities where bridge tolls are collected as well. And they're not just getting you by text. Sometimes they'll call you. Similar messages being received by cell phone users around the country in the markets with bridges and toll roads. The FastTrack saying in an email, customers who may have fallen for the scam and paid the bogus tolls should contact their banks and credit card companies. So don't be fooled. If FastTrack wants money from you, they're going to send you an official FastTrack letter. And also, everyone has a FastTrack account. So if you have questions, just go log into your FastTrack account. I know it's a pain because we probably forgot the password. It's all right, reset it. Better than paying someone, right, and going to some bogus website that's not real. So beware. The scammers are everywhere. Let's go to this story. This is so interesting. Thanks to Lori for sending it. This is I don't know if I'll say it. We've never seen anything like this. Yeah. It's a story about two life forms merging into one. The story out of Popular Science, and the headline reads, for the first time in 1 billion years, two life forms truly merged into one organism. Apparently this doesn't happen very often. The team of scientists looking at this say this is a major life event that hasn't occurred for 1 billion years. They've observed what's called primary endosymbiosis. That's two life forms merging into one organism. This rare event happened with an abundant marine algae and a bacterium, and it was observed in a lab setting. So we think it's taken 1 billion years, but maybe it's happening in nature and we just haven't seen it. The results of what happened in the lab here, this billion year phenomenon, published in the journal Cell and Science. So primary endosymbiosis happens when one microbial organism engulfs another, and then it begins to use the swallowed up organisms as an internal organ. The host provides the organism, now called an endosymbiont, several benefits, including nutrients, energy, and protection. And when it can no longer survive on its own, the engulfed endosymbiont becomes an organ for the host, called an organelle. Rare that organelles arise from these types of things, according to one of the co-authors of the study out of UC Santa Cruz. The first time they think it happened, it gave rise to all complex life. Endosymbiosis, where the host life form becomes fundamental to another organism's function, has only happened 3 known times, they say. All of these instances were major breakthroughs for evolution, since merging with their hosts became fundamental for the endosymbiont's existence. The first time, about 2.2 billion years ago, when a single-celled organism called archaea swallowed up bacterium that eventually became mitochondria. That specialized organelle is what every biology student learns is the powerhouse of the cell. And it was the formation that allowed for complex organisms to evolve. Everything more complicated than the bacterial cell owes its existence to that event. 1 billion years or so ago, it happened again with a chloroplast, and that gave us plants. So this, is interesting, right? This team of scientists say the process happens yet again in the lab. They looked at this species of algae called Barutosphera bigelowi. The algae engulfed a cyanobacterium and it gives it a bit of a plant superpower, apparently. It can fix nitrogen straight from the air and combine it with other elements to form more useful compounds. It's something plants normally can't do. I guess there's a reason for the engulfing. So the size ratio between the algae and the bacterium is similar across different species. The growth appears to be controlled by exchange of key nutrients linking up their metabolisms. This synchronization of growth rates led the researchers to call UCYN an organelle-like. They said that's exactly what happens with organelles. If you look at the mitochondria and the chloroplast, it's the same thing. They scale with the cell. So it's now called a nitroplast, is the new name for it. I guess we have a brand new thing. It's a nitroplast. There's going to be a lot more studies on this. They say they need to take a deeper look inside. They want to use X-ray imaging to get a look at the cells. A lot more study to be done, but interesting and a very, very rare event indeed. Animals, let's go to it. Apparently, there's so many snake bites in Australia. They're now at the hospital asking people, listen, don't bring the snake with you. It's important to know what kind of snake bit someone because that's the appropriate antivenom is then given, right? So you would think it would be helpful to know exactly what snake struck. But they're pleading the medical experts in Australia with snake bite victims to please stop bringing snakes with them to the hospital. They had one person that was a suspected snake bite victim that came in earlier this month with a highly venomous eastern brown snake in a poorly secured plastic container. The staff, they say, got a fright and it led to a delay in the treatment of the person who was suffering from the bite. They say we want people to be able to be seen and get assessed quickly, and having a live snake in the emergency room really slows down that process. I could see that would be, you know, a problem. A clinical toxicology researcher at the University of Newcastle says he's heard of several cases where the snake bite victims brought the snake with them when seeking treatment. And he says it's really dangerous because no one in the hospital will be able to identify it. So if the snake gets out in an emergency room, it becomes a huge disaster. The hospital staff is not trained to identify snakes. They can, though, perform tests to see whether a bite victim needs antivenom. They say we don't need the snake. We can determine if you need antivenom, and if so, what antivenom you need based on clinical signs, blood tests, also the snake venom detection kits that we keep here at the hospital. All right? Don't bring in the snake. One of the snake catchers in Australia says he's been called out to Bundaberg Hospital multiple times to relocate snakes brought in by patients. The Wild Bay Hospital and Health Service says not only do they then have to deal with the snake, but they have to wash the whole area. Yeah. So applying a tourniquet, cutting the wound, sucking the venom, or bringing the snake with you to emergency rooms, not recommended. So just so you know, maybe take a picture of it. Maybe that would be a better idea. Do you see this story? It's kind of a creepy story, I'll admit. I will admit. And a creepy picture to boot. The lamprey eel. I know. It's like an alien blood-sucking vampire-looking blah. Apparently, it serves quite a purpose when it comes to the origin of the fight-or-flight instinct, even for humans. Yeah. It's got quite the nervous system. And there's a scientific debate about how closely related we are to these eels. But scientists have found some evidence that the lamprey eels have a rudimentary sympathetic nervous system believed to control the fight or flight reaction in vertebrates. The findings detailed in a study in the journal Nature. And it could, they say, have us rethinking the origins of the sympathetic nervous system. The lampreys are the closest living organism scientists have to studying the fish ancestors that vertebrates evolved from about 550 million years ago. So they belong to this ancient vertebrate lineage called agnatha, or jawless fish. And some scientists think they represent the earliest group of vertebrates still living that can give us an evolutionary window into all of our vertebrate ancestors. So, there's not much of a fossil record when it comes to these things. But scientists previously believed these lampreys didn't have a sympathetic neuron, which is part of the nervous system, right? The nerves that target internal organs throughout our body, including the gut, the pancreas, the heart. It also helps an organism's body maintain homeostasis, making sure the heart keeps pumping, the digestive system keeps moving, all of this. In the new study, the team used lampreys to look at how developmental changes may have promoted the evolution of vertebrate traits like fight or flight. And they found evidence types of stem cells that eventually form the sympathetic neurons. The presence of these cells in lampreys could, they say, revise the timeline of when the sympathetic nervous system began to evolve. So, that's our brother, apparently. Did you know? Here's another crazy animal story. It's a little more sciencey than it is goofy. But I thought it was really interesting. Because it's a question I think a lot of us have had, right? When it comes to whether consciousness is a realistic possibility in animals like birds, fish, squid, and bees. And scholars say, yeah, it actually is. There's a reasonable possibility that the vast majority of creatures on Earth are sentient in some way. Interesting. There was released on Friday, a New York Declaration on Animal Consciousness. 39 signatories from universities across Canada, Australia, they say there's at least a realistic possibility that all vertebrates and many invertebrates have consciousness. It rests the studies on data showing garter snakes can recognize their own scent. Crows can report what they see, octopi or octopuses can avoid pain, and fruit flies can sleep, and they sleep best when they're with other fruit flies. Interesting. So scientific evidence then, according to a philosophy professor at York University, say it feels like something for a fish to be caught with a hook. It's not clear yet whether that's pain or distress or what. But the evidence shows it's reasonable to treat these creatures accordingly by adopting harvesting methods that kill fish quickly or abandon the practice of boiling lobsters alive. Because they think they know that they're somehow aware. Something to think about. Does that change the way you operate? I don't know. But I'll be thinking about it for a while. All right. How about something a little wackier? Lighten it up a little bit, Francis. Let's get to this one. This is a story about a world record. And I think, as a mom, I'm just thinking the cleanup, right? So they set a record for cannons firing off confetti all at the same time. Here's what that looked like.
More than a year of planning in a bid to make history bursting into life.
3, 2, 1, confetti.
Hundreds from St. Stephen's School coming together at its Duncrae campus to conquer a Guinness World Record.
We are here for the most people firing confetti cannons simultaneously.
It has never been attempted outside of North America.
I think we've got the people to do it.
Possibly, maybe.
Despite a false start.
Hold. Wait.
The record went off.
When it all happened, it was like, oh my God, this is sick.
It was really fun. Yeah. It was so cool.
2013 participants successfully smashing the previous achievement of 1,116 held for the past 2 years.
I can't believe we got over 2,000.
It feels amazing.
The staff and students here have well and truly celebrated the school's 40th anniversary with a bang, with expectations for its 50th certainly reaching new heights.
For the next one, they're going to really have to top this off. And I won't be here, but whoever's going to be here, I wish them all the best.
I'm definitely going to remember this forever.
So are you cleaning all of this up?
No. So it's biodegradable, so they'll turn the sprinklers on and then it kind of just all melts away.
Brianna in Ferreira. Yeah! For 10 News First.
Yeah, I doubt that it melts away. No, I don't think so. Right now, the school custodian is like, are you serious? This is what you've done to me? No, thank you. Let's talk about this story. I kind of want to call. Maybe we'll do it live here. This is a story about Oregon's poem of the day. Yeah, they have a poetry hotline, and you're going to hear a new poem every day this month. The hotline is created by the Oregon State Poet Laureate, and already they've received thousands of phone calls. So Anise Mojgani was named Oregon's Poet Laureate April of 2020, weeks after the COVID lockdown started. Without live poetry readings or other in-person gatherings, he started thinking about ways to bring lovers of literature together safely. So he had this idea, the Daily Telepoems telephone line. They have this thing, and April is National Poetry Month, so you can call and listen to a poem being read just to you. Should we try it? I mean, it could be lame. It could be good. I mean, I wonder how long the poem is. If it goes on too long, we'll have to beg out of it. But I thought maybe, well, let's try it, right? Let's see what they have to say in Oregon. Oops. All right. Here it is.
Hello. Thank you for calling Oregon's Telepoem Poetry Hotline, where throughout April, National Poetry Month, you can call and listen to a poem being read for you. Please stay on the line to hear today's poem.
Oh, they
or
make
press
you
9
wait?
To be taken directly to the main menu.
Come
for other
on.
Options.
That's rude.
First Light by Shandel Beers. For my son who confused airplanes and babies. When the baby learns to fly, he flew over wind tree and grass green, neigh horse and moo cow.
Hmm.
He stopped over the river like an osprey looking for swish fish.
All right. I mean, it's interesting. It's a good idea. I hate the AI voice. Did you think that was an AI voice? I kind of thought it. I thought it was. But interesting idea, poem of the day. I think I would call and listen to it. I don't know. Let's go to science. How about that? Actually, let's go to the chat, see what you guys are talking about and thinking about. Poetry hotline, says Jim. There's no hashtag on that phone. No. It would be great if it was a limerick, right? If it was catchy. You can't read this long, like, and the babies fly. Oh, yeah. Well, that was a trip. It's true. Hey, that's Mark's phone. Does look like it. Exactly. Karen says, regarding the confetti, there's paper made of rice that dissolves in water. Maybe that's what they used. I don't know. All right. By the way, if you're interested in calling the poetry line of the day, I'll give you the number. It's 503-928-7008. 503-928-7008. And they'll have a poem of the day throughout April. So we've got a few days left to hear the poem of the day. Maybe we'll call every day and see what they have to say. I don't know. Teacher Lori says, you should be able to choose between the haiku, the sonnet, the freestyle, the limerick, etc. Yeah, it's true. When I was little, says Sandy, when I was a kid, there used to be something called dial a story. I used to dial it all the time to hear the stories. That's cool. Still should be dial a story. Now it's kind of YouTube, right? Yeah. Let's talk about this interesting phenomenon. We kind of mentioned it, I think, on the show earlier, and I have video. Check this out. Yeah, it's pretty cool. Boom. Love this. That's a nova explosion, what you just saw. And apparently pretty rare. Let me take the phone down. Pretty rare is what I understand. A nova explosion. Yeah. And that apparently happens once every 80 years, where a distant remnant of a star will grow much brighter, briefly becoming visible to Earth. So this new star will be visible in the night sky. And the story out of Smithsonian Magazine talks about how to catch a glimpse of it. Some point, they say, over the next several months, this distant dead star will rapidly grow brighter in a powerful explosion, making it visible from Earth for just a very short period of time. To observers on the ground, it will look like a new star. The dead star, currently not bright enough to appear in the sky, is one of a pair that orbit each other in a binary system called T Coronae Borealis. It's known as a white dwarf. This leftover stellar core, taking material from its neighboring red giant, and when it gathers enough, that's about once every 80 years, the white dwarf releases energy in a bright burst, according to NASA. Astronomers are awaiting this short-lived event. They say when it goes off, a large fraction of every telescope in the world will be pointed right at it. It's about 3,000 light years from Earth. One astronomer in Ireland noticed the explosion two explosions ago. In 1886, according to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, then it flared up again in 1946. There's evidence that it was seen in 1787 and 1217, per the New York Times. So such an event is called a nova, which is a rapid increase in the brightness of the white dwarf that reignites after years of slumber. And this outburst is often called a supernova. Mm-hmm. Which is much more dramatic. Supernova occur when a dying star erupts a release of energy that can briefly outshine galaxies. So, how to see the nova explosion? Most likely not with the naked eye. You're going to need they say you won't need, it's usually too dim to see from Earth with the naked eye, but at the peak of this explosion, that's when it's bright enough, and they say you might not actually need equipment to see it. So the problem is knowing exactly when it's going to occur. So they're guessing right now. They say from the last eruption back in 1946, the star gets dimmer for about a year before rapidly increasing in brightness. So March of last year, they saw the dimming, and they say it's likely to go off between now and September. So unless you're really looking up in the sky all the time trying to find it, which there are people that will, it'll be a rare moment in astronomy, they say. Another one. In Italy, they're trying to do this thing where they ban ice cream after midnight. They've been talking about doing this for a while. And it looks like, that may actually be in the works. There's my ice cream picture. Mm-hmm. Milan is poised to ban ice cream, pizza, and more after midnight. It's a new proposed law there. They tried to do this in 2013, but failed. And so now they're back at it, trying to get late night ice cream eaters off their streets. So the local government in Milan is proposing this new law that could go into effect next month. For many, they say the late night gelato is part of the Italian culture. But a legislative starting paper filed by the city's local government could see the late night ice creams banned. All takeaway food banned. Pizza, drinking after midnight as well, in an effort to clamp down on noisy groups crowding the streets of the Italian city and keeping the local residents awake. The goal, they say, is to seek a balance between socializing and entertainment and the peace and tranquility of residents. Who knew eating ice cream after midnight was causing such a hubbub? The proposal would be effective from mid-May until at least November. It would kick in at 12:30 a.m. on weekdays and 1:30 a.m. on weekends and public holidays, applying to outdoor tables only in an effort to clear out the streets. So they're right now at the point where they're seeking input from citizens. It's not, you know, as we mentioned, the first time they've tried to do this. But there was a big backlash in 2013 when they tried to do the ice cream ban. There was an Occupy Gelato movement. People can eat ice cream day and night, anywhere they like. That's what protesters are saying. And we'll see how it goes this time. I mean, I tend to think if you live in a tourist city, you live in a tourist city, you know? And you probably wouldn't have moved there if you didn't know that it was a popular tourist destination for whatever reason. You fell in love with it. You grew up there. You grew up dealing with tourists, what have you. I used to live in San Francisco, right around the corner from Alamo Square Park, where the Painted Lady Victorians are. And there were always tour buses in the neighborhood. I mean, if it bothered me, all the tourists milling around, then I wouldn't live there, right? And so, I don't know, I think there's a certain expectation when you live in an area that there's, it's a place of great beauty and significance. And with that comes the pain in the rear end of dealing with tourists. I'm sure people in Sausalito deal with that all the time. When I lived in Santa Cruz, you know, a lot of tourists coming in over the weekend to go to the beaches, roadways clogged, whatever, but it was good for business. And you have to share the beauty of the beaches and the Santa Cruz sunsets with people. This is just the way of the world. So I don't know. I can get why at night you want your residents to be able to sleep and you don't want partying crazy loud tourists in the street. I don't know. What do you guys think of the ice cream ban? Think they should do it? Do you live in a tourist area? Would you want laws restricting tourism and people's ability to enjoy your area? Knit One says, areas can change. I'm from Santa Cruz. Yes, tourists in the summer, weekends. Exactly. And you make them, you kind of change your life around it, right? I mean, you know there's going to be beach traffic. So maybe you're not going to downtown Santa Cruz, or maybe you're not traveling Highway 17 in beach traffic on the way home on a Sunday evening. You're just not. Yeah. Half of San Jose was in Santa Cruz. Exactly. What do they call it? The valleys on the weekend? Beth says, no, having grown up in a town that wasn't touristy, but sure is now, locals hate it. Yeah. Lori says, put in the earplugs, man. Let people enjoy it. I kind of agree. Murphy says, I don't live in a tourist area, and it's super annoying when you can't get late night food. Exactly. Nothing's open. BW Rock says, move to Del Norte County if you don't want tourists. See? I agree with you guys. I think, you know, you live in an area, you just know that this is part of the deal. And you're lucky to live there. So there's a, I don't know how many of you use Tinder, this dating app, but there's a new way they're trying to make it a little bit safer for people. And you can now share your date with someone. It's a safety feature. So law enforcement agencies were warning of an increase in the number of assaults connected to dating online. And so after they were investigating, a Tinder spokesperson said, listen, letting friends and family know the details of your date should be part of your date ready checklist. And I agree. If you're going to go meet a stranger for the first time, tell someone where you're going, what time you're expecting to meet the person, what time you're expecting to be home, right? You don't know this person. Always make it a public date, especially the first time. Don't go to their house for dinner. So they have this new Share My Date on Tinder, which allows the users to share the location, the time, and a photo of their match. That makes it a lot safer, doesn't it? More than 1 in 10 online adults in the UK are using dating apps. Nearly 2.5 million adults using it in the UK. This story's out of the UK. Sky News is where I found it. A number of people now date online, and they still have safety concerns when it comes to, they say, swiping right, ranging from scams and stalking, even to assault. Nearly a quarter of online daters experience digital stalking. That, according to research from a cybersecurity firm called Kaspersky, 10% admitting their location had been tracked, another 10% reporting their social media accounts or emails had been hacked. So, that's kind of scary, right? Makes you not want to go out on these dates. But the number of young people, I don't know about older folks, but according to this story, the UK National Crime Agency is suggesting the number of young people facing sexual assault after meeting online dates has risen in a number of years, especially involving women aged 19 and under. The reports involving such assaults after an online date rose by more than 80% in 6 years. That according to this National Crime Agency out of the UK. Proportion of incidents of this type involving men rose by nearly 24%. So, they say anyone dating online should be aware of the potential dangers so they can be better prepared and make choices that are right for them. The date ready checklist, letting friends and family know who you're meeting, where you can make your date safer, sharing the details of your plans should be part of the date ready checklist. A lot of people already share their date details with friends and family. I like that the person would have a picture. Now, it's online, so not everyone's picture is accurate, right? But at least there's something you can do to try to make yourself safer. The Share My Date streamlined the basic info sharing so singles can jump right to the exciting part, they say. The Share My Date rolling out across the UK, the United States, and Australia and more in the coming months. Something they probably should have done from the beginning. It's great. We talked about this on Mark's show, this clear situation. We just saw this. I thought we could talk a little more about it because one of the things that they had to say was that basically clear and other things like it, which allow you to pay to basically skip in line, right? Allows rich people to just jump in front of the line. And some of the state lawmakers here in California are saying that's not fair. That is not fair at all. This bill would prevent vendors like Clear Secure from using standard security or the Transportation Security Administration pre-check security lanes for their expedited services. You'd have to have a special thing if you want. You don't get to take up the regular security lines where regular people are going through just because you get to pay more for the service. You know, they don't get to scoop up some of the lines for the rich people, is what they're saying. So the vendors would be required to use their own dedicated security lane or lose the ability to operate in California airports starting in 2025. The least you can expect when you have to go through security, according to the author of this bill, who's Senator Josh Newman, a Democrat from a part of Los Angeles, he says, the least you can expect when you have to go through a security at the airport is that you don't suffer the indignity of someone pushing you out of the way to let a rich person pass you. It's really what it is. If you have the money to pay for Clear or the TSA pre-check, wouldn't you do it? And I mean, granted, I don't know if you say rich person, because what is it? I think I was reading earlier, Dillette said $80 a year for the TSA pre-check, $189 a year for the other, the Clear. So it's not, you know, like you're paying, they're paying thousands to skip the line, but they're paying more than other people who may have the, you know, bargain basement ticket on at the back of the Southwest airline. The bill would ban Clear from operating operating at state airports. Six major airlines, Delta, United, Southwest, Alaska, JetBlue, and Hawaiian, all opposing this. They're saying revenue loss from Clear would increase airfare tickets. Isn't that interesting? So we'll see if it passes. I mean, there's a lot of reason to do it. I tend to think the more people you can pre-clear, the quicker the line moves, right? So if those people, even though they paid for it, are taken out of line and quickly put through because all of their information has already been verified, there's special staff from these companies to check everything, as long as they're doing it right, it just means there's a shorter line for me to get through. But I do like that they have to have their own lines, that their own area, and not clog up the lines for everybody else. That makes sense to me. You guys ready for the lotto story of the day? Let's do it. This is a lady. I don't know how I'd feel if I was her kid. This is a lady from Virginia. She sends her son to the store. This woman, she wins $1 million from a Powerball ticket that her son gave her because he was leaving on a vacation. Her name is Maria Roldan. She said her son gave her the Powerball ticket he bought from the 7-Eleven because he was leaving for vacation and he wouldn't be around for the drawing. Well, check the numbers when you get home, you bonehead. The ticket matched the first five winning numbers in the March 11th drawing, making her the only $1 million winner in the country that night. Her son accompanied her to claim her winnings at the Virginia Lottery headquarters. He recalled his reaction upon finding out how much she'd won. "You're kidding me, right?" he said. Can you imagine? Don't you think she has to give him the money? Wouldn't you? It wasn't your ticket. And who gives someone a lottery ticket because you're leaving the country for a bit? I don't know. There's this author that did something I thought was a little interesting. This story out of CNN. She calculated how much racism had benefited her. And she didn't come from a particularly wealthy family. But she took a look at the advantages that she received over her lifetime thus far from being white. And that includes a family bonus, which includes money her parents spent on her college tuition, education loans she got from her grandfather, an inheritance, a social bonus, which included jobs, apartments, and access to credit that she's received through her life. The resources and capital, she said, wouldn't have been available to her if it weren't for her race. So she wrote a new book. It's called The White Bonus: Five Families and the Cash Value of Racism in America. And she traced just how much of her family's wealth could be attributed to the policies and practices that have hurt Black Americans. She's calculated the advantages she's received over her life from being white are about $371,934.30. Call it $370,000. That's how much of an advantage she thinks that she has had over her lifetime for being white. I think the number would vary for everyone because not everyone's family paid for them to go to college. Not everyone's family, you know, gave an inheritance or their grandparents were able to loan them money to go to college. Not every white person had those advantages. But she looked at a couple of few different families, and that's the number, she says, $370,000. So is that the number then that's appropriate for reparations? This woman grew up in Michigan, and she said her name's Tracy McMillan, and she said she didn't have a particularly privileged upbringing by most standards. She grew up in an abusive household. Her mom had an accident that left her unable to care for the kids. In college, McMillan had a bunch of jobs trying to support herself. She's had her own brushes with poverty as a working journalist. Don't I know it? And she said the financial advantages she's experienced because of her race, even with all of that, are still undeniable. Her grandparents benefited from a federal program that largely excluded Black people, allowing them to build wealth that was then passed to the next generation, which enabled her parents to pay for her to attend an elite university, which opened doors to employment opportunities. While those opportunities came with a cost, she said, they still exist. She said, I work as a journalist. I've gotten pretty good at understanding, at least structurally, how racism hits people who aren't white. And I started to feel just listening to people who aren't white talk about racism and how bad it was wasn't sufficient to fix the problem. And that's why she did this research. She said, I felt like I needed to take some responsibility for myself and understand how things were working on my end. So the white bonus is an estimate of the money a white person gets or saves because of white supremacy in our culture, public policies, private practices. She said for her, this was a very humbling exercise. Her book is called The White Bonus, Five Families and the Cash Value of Racism in America. Have an interesting study. I mean, I think the number would be different for everyone. And I don't know exactly how you would go about trying to figure it all out. But the thought of it is interesting, kind of makes you think a little bit about what maybe advantages you have had, or maybe you haven't. I don't know. There's the book title, The White Bonus. Interesting. Yeah. Again, something that makes you think. Did you hear, speaking of something that makes you think, about Taylor Swift's new album? I know we don't have a lot of Swifties in the crowd. I'm kind of a Swiftie because I have a 14-year-old daughter who sucked me into all of this Swiftiness. Doing really well, which surprised me because the night the album came out, my daughter put it on Spotify and we listened to it all together and I read the words and it's rough. I mean, the album is, it's a wowzer. She really lays her heart and soul all out there. And if it is indeed her heart and soul, there's some dark spots in there. It's painful. This is a painful album to listen to in some areas, some songs. Yet, this album is breaking records. The latest album, The Tortured Poets Department, has become the most streamed album on its first day across Spotify, Amazon Music, and Apple Music. 300 million streams in a single day on Friday when the album was released, on Spotify alone. It's become the most streamed album in a single day in just 12 hours. Amazon and Apple also said Swift's album broke records across their streaming platforms. The album broke the record for the biggest pop album of all time by first day streams. The Amazon Music saying The Tortured Poets Department, the name of the album, had in just 3 days become the music service's most streamed album worldwide in its first week. The opening track is called Fortnite, and that was the most streamed song in a single day on Spotify. So, even though its content might not be shake it off, hip hop, and happy, it's, you know, it shows that she has a lot of power, I think. Speaking of music, they are out with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductees for 2024. And they include, as you can see here, Cher, Mary J. Blige, Dave Matthews, also not pictured, Foreigner, Peter Frampton, Kool and the Gang, Ozzy Osbourne, A Tribe Called Quest, Jimmy Buffett, MC5, Dionne Warwick, and Norman Whitfield were selected as the recipients for the Musical Excellence Award. The announcement made Sunday during the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame night episode on American Idol. So, nominees this year included Sinead O'Connor, Lenny Kravitz, Mariah Carey as well. The 2024 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony happens in October. So they're going to stream it on Disney Plus and then ABC and then Hulu in the following days. So if you pay attention to such things, I wanted to make sure you were aware of it. Here's a great way to end the show. Boobs. Why don't we talk about boobies? Why not? Right? Boobs as art. There's a lot of pictures I won't be showing you because they're a little more graphic. Some of them even historical. But there's a major art exhibition. And it's all about breasts. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's in Italy, hosted at the Palazzo Franchetti. On display at the 60th Venice Biennale. The show includes artworks by Cindy Sherman, Robert Mapplethorpe, Salvador Dali. All kinds of artists in this. They're divided into five rooms meant to be in conversation with one another. They have early works, 16th century Madonna and Child. They have a self-portrait with prosthetic breasts. I mean, it's all boobs all the time. And they say really that breasts and nudity and as it is linked to art really goes back to cave paintings even. That humans have always been fascinated by the human form, particularly the female form, which, according to art experts, has an allure and mystery to it. A delicate rendering of the breast as a landscape, artists keep going back to it. Keep going back to the boob. That's the way it is. It's a wonderful moment to contemplate relationships with the meaning of breasts. I mean, there's a lot to that, right? There's sexuality, there's childbirth, there's illness, there's all kinds of things and thoughts about this. But if you look at the article on CNN, you kind of scroll down, you can see all the pictures. So interesting through time, the way that we see breasts and express them in art. So breasts, the art exhibition, was staged to promote breast cancer awareness. And they will receive this nonprofit foundation for breast cancer will receive a portion of catalog sales for people that buy any of the art there. But it's very vivid. They have the whole thing in pink, right? You can see there the booby trap on the pink box, draped in pink fabric. So, kind of interesting. Boobs. What a great way to end the show. Thank you for being here. Please, please, please click on the like button and the subscribe button as well. I would really appreciate your help in that regard. Tomorrow, we'll see you on the Nikki Maduro Show at 10 o'clock. We have a recorded show for you, a little short one. And then 11 o'clock, again, the Mark Thompson Show. You'll see one of the candidates for mayor of San Francisco, Mark Farrell, on the show. It's a David K. Johnston day. So a good Mark Thompson show ahead. And then we'll see you right back here on the After Party Live for Travel Tuesday, where we'll take a little trip together. All right. I hope you guys have a great rest of your Monday. Make it a great day, and I'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
The After Party Live would like to thank the following contributors and viewers like you.